On FM, digital and your mobile. Cambridge 105 Radio.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Delicious.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt Bentman.
I'm Alan Alder.
I'm Sue Bailey.
And we welcome you to Flavour. Thanks also to Ollie Slack for the last hour.
And today on Flavour, we hear Alex Rushmer talking about developing the menu for his new restaurant, Vanderlyle, which opens next week.
We'll probably try it with a rosti this week, maybe a pain boulanger, but we're flavouring it with Lapsang Souchong tea, which gives an amazing smoky richness and a depth of flavour.
Also designing dishes is Rosie Sykes for her forthcoming book.
It evolves quite slowly. So I'll start, for example, with an ingredient that I think would be a nice sort of star of the recipe.
We hear some Hertfordshire sausages that are very popular in Cambridgeshire.
Well, this is why sausages are called bangers, because in the old days, they put so much fat in them, they went bang. If you put them in a hot pan, that's what's going to happen.
Local writer Bea Wilson talks about her new book, The Way We Eat Now.
It seems that poor diet now causes more death and disease in the world than either tobacco or alcohol, which absolutely just stopped me in my tracks when I read that.
And Christian Foreman will be talking about Love Cambridge Restaurant Week.
And to begin with, Rosie Sykes, patron of this year's Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival. She has a new cookery book on the way. Alan asked her about it and how you develop new recipes.
I'm writing for the National Trust, which for me is a really fun thing to do because the recipes are much more important than the personality in a way. So one of the things, obviously, that I love about writing a book is creating recipes.
Well, I've always wondered how you create a recipe. You know, are there any basic principles?
The process for me, it evolves quite slowly. So I'll start, for example, with an ingredient that I think would be a nice sort of star of the recipe. And then I think about all the things that might go with it and work out how to bring them in. So, for example, I had a friend who ran the half marathon the other day and he was coming to have lunch with me afterwards. So I thought I need to make him something nice and sturdy and filling. And the recipe book is going to be about roasting pan suppers. So the idea is all in one in the oven meals, 75 recipes, which is quite an ask, but we'll get there. So I had decided I wanted to bake a small piece of gammon in the oven for him. And I ended up baking it with loads and loads of leeks, which all broke down, with some cider. So it steamed and baked at the same time. And I thought leeks and cider, lovely. Another obvious thing is a bit of mustard. Then I thought, well, I need some carbohydrate in there, but why not, instead of potatoes, why don't I do some pasta? So I blanched some pasta and stirred it in at the end with some mustard and some sour cream and some greens. So it's just working out all the elements you need to make a rounded dish without it being too complicated or too intricate, really.
And do all of them work?
Well, yeah, there can be some bloopers, but you just have to dust yourself off. And if you know that the essential main part is good, you just keep trying again. But, yeah, it's very interesting. It's very interesting when people... I've had a couple of people cook my recipes for me, and that's quite anxious-making because you think, oh, gosh, if it doesn't work out, does that mean I've got it wrong? Or, you know, it's tricky, as opposed to people writing to you and saying, I made your recipe, it was great. For me to eat somebody who's cooked my recipe, I find quite tricky.
But you've got to do it, presumably, otherwise...
Yeah, for sure.
You don't know whether your instructions are...
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So with The Kitchen Revolution, the third author was someone who couldn't cook at all, and we were writing the book for her. And when she first started testing the recipes, I'd be there at the house with her, watching her. But after a little while, I realised that I couldn't actually do that because obviously, as a professional, even watching her chop was quite... it was quite anxious. Anxious isn't the right word. It was quite difficult to watch. I mean, she was brilliant and she did really, really well. But it made me very aware how important it is to make things as simple as possible, really.
She must have had quite a job because there's so many recipes in the Kitchen Revolution.
She had a year. She had a year to do it. Yeah. So, and we had lots of other testers as well, which is always great to have other people.
Right. And your other book, The Sunday Night Book, how's that gone?
Really well. That's selling really well. And I'm so happy with that book. It's just a real little gem. And people have responded really, really well to it. So I hope at some point I could make a second one in that sort of series.
It's quite a slim volume, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Tomes.
It's a nice, not quite pocket size book, but a nice bedside book and easy, quick recipes mainly.
Yeah.
So yes, I'd love to see a second volume at some point. We will see.
That was Rosie Sykes on her next book. Now, some other Cambridge people who are developing recipes at the moment are Alex Rushmer and Lawrence Butler of Vanderlyle, and this is opening on Mill Road on Wednesday. Here is Alex from a field near Cambridge to tell us what's going on.
Hello, my name is Alex Rushmer. I'm a chef and food writer based in Cambridge, formerly of The Hole in the Wall, and soon to be cooking at Vanderlyle on Mill Road in the centre of Cambridge. This is a little audio diary that I'm recording for Cambridge 105 in the run-up to actually opening the doors. I'm currently walking through the fields on a pretty glorious spring morning with my little whippet Toby, who's just dashed off into the distance. And it felt like an apt moment in which to just lay down some brief thoughts and explain how the project came about, and just briefly explain where we're up to now and how far away we are from actually opening the doors. Anyone that has walked past Vanderlyle on Mill Road in the last week will hopefully have seen a fairly significant transformation in what was once a clothes shop called Barney's, and more recently was a sandwich shop called Subway, in that it is no longer a building site, but it looks very much like a fully functioning and a really quite beautiful restaurant. It's one that I'm immensely proud of. It certainly makes all the hard work very much worthwhile, seeing it come together like this. So there's a little bit of snagging to do. There's some final things to buy, just to make sure that we're fully ready when everyone starts to come through the doors at the beginning of April. Reservations have been open now for just over a month, and the response has been incredible. We've sold around about 75% of available reservations for April and May. But the process of creating a restaurant, is one that doesn't happen overnight. The project has been well over a year, probably close to 18 months in its gestation. And seeing it all come together now has been an immensely rewarding experience. I think anyone that's started their own business will appreciate that there are always a huge number of decisions to make, and that has been evident throughout this whole opening, or this whole building process and creative process at Vanderlyle. Everything from paint colours, design schemes, the layout of the kitchen, what the menu will look like, what our social media policy is going to be, what wines we would like on the wine list, what beers we would like to list, what our food and wine pairings are going to be, who we need to recruit, what levels we need to recruit, how to train them. And that's before we even begin to talk about a menu. Fortunately, I'm working with some really exceptional people that I've worked with before, and they have helped make this whole process actually remarkably easy. We have begun cooking in the kitchen. The kitchen is functional and operational. We've had a couple of nights of friends and family booked in. We've got another 5 or 6 nights of what we call soft launch, which is hopefully some friendly faces coming to tell us what we're doing right, and more importantly what we're doing wrong, so that when the doors finally open on April the 3rd, we're as close to being able to offer what we believe to be the best possible hospitality experience. I've created a restaurant that is small. It's only 26 people, room for 26 people. Say a warm, welcoming, relaxed environment, very much with a focus on excellent produce, vegetable-driven produce, with further down the line some sustainably and ethically sourced meat and fish, but only when it makes sense to us. We very much want to focus on cooking local produce, and some of the best local produce I've ever had is all vegetable based. We're working very closely with a number of farmers, number of growers, and it's them who will decide what shape the menu takes. Things come into season on a weekly basis. Our desire for Van der Lyle was to flip the whole process on its head, really, and rather than having a chef-led menu, to have a seasonally led menu. This is a far more exciting and slightly more challenging process, but one that I know will be hugely rewarding, hugely satisfying, and terrific amounts of fun. A few of the dishes we're working on at the moment that I'm pretty sure will make their way onto the opening menu. It's a really quite spectacular purple sprouting broccoli dish that we're serving with labneh, which is it's like a soft cheese, strained yogurt from the Middle East. We're cooking the broccoli with a bagna cauda, which is a traditional Italian sauce made of lemons and garlic and olive oil, and usually anchovies. We're replacing the anchovies with miso, which gives a very similar, deep, rich flavour, but is vegetarian. For a bit of texture, we're using almonds, broccoli and almonds, a lovely combination, just with some fresh herbs through the toasted almonds. And then it's finished just with some raw purple sprouting broccoli and other brassica leaves, which give an amazing slight peppery freshness to the dish. Something else we're working on is a mushroom dish, a mushroom main course. And in order to try and emulate the sort of satisfaction of meat, we're treating large mushrooms, we're using king oyster mushrooms, but we're treating them as a piece of meat. So we're pan frying them in butter and serving them with very rich and smoky elements to try and recreate the satisfaction of eating meat without actually having any meat or fish on the plate. We're serving it with a smoked potato element that we haven't actually decided on yet. We tried it with a dauphinoise, we tried it with a pomme Anna. We'll probably try it with a roche d'Or this week, maybe a pomme boulangère, but we're flavouring it with lapsang souchong tea, which gives an amazing smoky richness and a depth of flavour. And we're making a sauce, traditionally made what we call a jus, which is a reduction usually of meat stocks, but we, instead of meat, we're using mushrooms and chickpeas and reducing that down into it until it's a very, very rich, thick sauce with an incredibly generous flavour. I think you'd be hard pushed to realise that it actually didn't contain any meat. We're also including some vegetables in dessert. I won't say too much about that, but the dessert that we're going to be opening with actually features celeriac, which is an incredible item to use in dessert. It does have a sweetness, it has a slight spiciness to it as well, and pairs amazingly with white chocolate, believe it or not. If you want to try the menu. We'd be delighted to cook for you. All our reservations are now open. We've got only about a quarter of the reservations for April and May left. Reservations for June will open at the start of April. You can book online at exploretalk.com/vanderlyle, and you can follow the progress of the restaurant either on my Instagram account at Chef Alex or at the restaurant's Instagram account, which is at vanderlyle restaurant. I hope you've enjoyed this first of a sort of pre-opening diary. I think I'll be recording a few more of these as the weeks go on. But in the meantime, have a very lovely weekend. Thank you.
Well, that was Alex Rushmer from Vanderlyle. Well, that's fantastic. I hope he caught up with his whippet eventually. We didn't get any sound of it at all. Obviously gone miles. But anyway, doesn't Vanderlyle sound fantastic?
Really
the,
does.
The dishes there just sound wonderful. Really impressive. So I'm going, I think, just about a week after it opens. So I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Excellent.
And here's news now of some free food available in Cambridge and South Cambridgeshire at this moment, and you can find it on the Olio app.
Yes, Olio, as usual, is free to download on iOS and Android, phones and tablets. Using your location, it will tell you the food that is nearest to you. And a quick look this time around tells us that Jordan, who lives just off Mill Road near the train station, has some tins to give away. This includes chopped tomatoes, red kidney beans, pea and ham soup and bellotti beans. These are available for pickup with him anytime. Next up, Kimberly near Green End Road, just behind Starbridge Common, has 3 packs of Green's Cheesecake Mix. You can contact her to arrange times for pickup. And finally, Donna, over in Orchard Park, has a pot of Ballymaloe Original Relish, which she can leave in a safe place for anybody interested. Now, that's just a little taster of things available on the Olio app, so why not give it a try? And remember, there is some great food given away during the week too.
Now we head back to Cambridge Market to see what else is new. In our last episode, it was the Halloo Man, and this time it's all about apples and pears and honey and flowers.
I used to fly aeroplanes. I was an airline pilot for 22 years. I started from university studying astrophysics, then worked for British Airways. During the redundancy period, I went out and studied commercial horticulture. And it's purely by chance with a colleague I used to fly with who used to buy honey off me. And he said, why aren't you selling on Cambridge Market? If you come to the Cambridge Market on a Sunday, it's a growers and farmers market. And I thought, do you know, that's such a good idea. It never occurred to me.
We love it. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
And we come here every Sunday, 7 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we're delighted to see anybody who wants to come and say hello, and they can have a free taste of our honey, and usually they buy.
This is Tim Henderson. He and his partner, Alina, are quite new to Cambridge Market. Their stall, the canvas roof above their stall, the poles holding up the canvas, they're all decorated with flowers from their garden.
We have Magnolia grandiflora out the front this morning, this afternoon.
Solangiana.
Oh, no, Solangiana, beg your pardon. Is that Magnolia Solangiana?
So, they're quite easy to spot.
The name of the stand is Warden House, which is our own garden, our own house. 3 acres of mature garden and orchard, so we get to pick most of the stuff from our own garden.
Oh, you've got a present for me.
Yes, it's a little bit. You will adjust the whole.
They're getting a little bit soft. Yeah,
because no, I love them like this.
They might be a little bit overripe. I couldn't sell.
These pears are so good. No, they really are. I mean, I love apples, but since I've been eating your pears, I've been definitely, you know, the pears go first. They're just so sweet, just like you two. No, I'm a big fan. I mean, I come every week, don't I?
You do?
Yeah, it must have been freezing this morning.
We're just improving now because the sun's coming down southwest now, so suddenly it opens up on this side of the market.
There's plenty of life on all sides of the market, including music.
Okay, all right, it can be on the radio, will it?
Yes, it will, yes, yeah. And you'll be like a backing track to this feature on an apple and honey store.
Oh, I never would have predicted that today. Yeah. The day is full of surprises for me.
We're hardy beasts here.
You have to be.
All wizened and gnarled and whatever. Probably need a pair of secateurs to be pruned.
Like your best trees.
Life's been the same. Only fools rush in.
Every Sunday. We try every Sunday.
And they have organic.
Yeah, so this is a good place to get organic vegetables and fruits. And it's also fun.
And flowers. It's amazing flowers.
The variety that you would find in a supermarket is very limited in terms of apples. Maybe only five or six different varieties. Yeah.
Yes, we have a lot of varieties, or cultivars is the correct terminology to use, in our orchards. We have probably about 30 different cultivars which people would not have heard of. Apples like Peas Good Nonsuch. It's a wonderful apple, beautiful flat spreading tree, gives the most ginormous apples.
We come nearly every Sunday because we find organic food and local produce, really. It's better than buying from supermarkets. We trust it more.
I see you're very conservationist. You bring your own brown bags with you as well.
Yeah, we try and reuse them. But this is maybe the eighth time that we're using the same bags. We bring them every Sunday until they tear, and then we get new ones.
Typical of the people here, everybody brings their own bags.
I love to buy from the growers. You know, you meet them, they're in touch with the tree. You know, I can go and talk to the trees. If I ask them, they might let me hug a tree that I'm eating an apple from. And that, I don't know, that matters to me.
We do a recycling scheme. Someone buys something plastic off us, we'll take it back off them. We clean it, reuse it. If it's broken, well, we'll probably try and use it as a seed tray or something of that nature. We try not to throw anything away. We try and do it without the plastic. We have brown paper carrier bags here. We go with what Cambridge people do. And I think it's marvellous. Save the planet.
Lots of fruits and honeys, and then we buy the apples and pears from here.
And it's more a family kind of environment. Like, he knows him and he keeps the fruit for him while he does the shopping around to other stalls.
Yeah.
Excellent.
We grow apples, pears, plums, cherries, apricots, blackcurrants, redcurrants, raspberries. Pretty well everything we can possibly grow, because we, as I say, Alina and I are both vegetarians. We don't want fruit which is sprayed with anything else, so if you want it, you've got to grow it yourself. We have some rather strange names to things. We talked about the Peas Good Nonsuch apple. We have Arthur Turner, Edward VII, Charles Ross. Perhaps, and your listeners might be interested to hear this one, my favourite one is an apple called Chivers Delight.
Yeah.
Absolute fabulous taste about it. I had never heard of it before until I read about it some years ago. The reason you won't see it in any supermarket or whatever is it's slightly prone to biennial bearing. In other words, it might have a good year, it might have a bad year. Commercial growers won't grow it because of that. You can work your way around it. You can prune it hard when it's got masses of fruit on it. You can try and leave it alone when it's having a thin year. Chivers Delight's one of the nicest apples you'll ever come across, but as I say, you're highly unlikely to see it in any supermarket. With regards to the plums, Rivers Early Prolific, fabulous taste, wonderfully dark plum. We got a fabulous selection of them at home. And obviously, because it's Cambridge, we also grow Cambridge Gauge. Wonderfully sweet. A lady we had come here who's French, she said, oh, it tastes just like the Mirabelle plums that she had from home back in France. And would you believe it, because of her, I've gone out and bought a Mirabelle plum tree just for her. In many respects, the honey is very, very flavoursome because we have our own hives. The bees go selecting on our borage, and we have a lot of lime trees, so that all gives the honey a wonderful summer flavour. It's natural, and we try and produce something which is flavoursome. Well, now I know people like you like to eat honey, I can have lots of honey to sell.
Honey by itself is so good, but it's hard to get off your fingers and into your mouth.
Mm. Borage officinalis is its Latin name. It's got a wonderful blue to purple flower which produces lots and lots of nectar, and that's what the bees will go for.
I think we'll have a lot more honey than that to be a
end of this summer?
I'm going to have about half a ton of honey next summer, I think.
A ton, Mum?
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Do you want to try the honey?
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. Take a stick, pop it in, swirl it around so you get plenty on it. Matt, we've been doing the market now since last August, and we've actually become personal friends with quite a few people. And it's charming, you know, we don't know people on their first name terms. Other people come and ask us, what's your names? And we say, well, Tim and Alina, what's yours? We're here to help, we're here to sell, but above all, we love meeting people and enjoying their company.
Lovely, well, thank you very much, Tim.
Matt, lovely to meet you, and I hope this interview goes out well for you. If you're coming through the market, do come and say hello.
Thanks very much as well, Elena.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And welcome everybody to us, because it's a celebration for everybody.
That's cool.
Really interesting, isn't it? Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Hope you enjoy yourself on the radio. Bye-bye now.
Many thanks to Tim and Alina Henderson. Their store is called Warden House, and you can find them there every Sunday. And that's for all your fruit, veg, honey and flower needs.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. Local food writer Bea Wilson has a new book out. It's called How We Eat Now, and Bea talked with Alan about it yesterday.
It seems that poor diet now causes more death and disease in the world than either tobacco or alcohol, which absolutely just stopped me in my tracks when I read that. Every year, The Lancet publishes a huge overview, the Global Burden of Diseases study, which attempts to isolate the cause of death in lots of different ways, and it does separate out air pollution, stress, poor diet, tobacco, alcohol, many different causes. But you could say there never is one single tipping point in a death. And you could also say correlation isn't cause. And, you know, sometimes some of these studies I've read, you sort of where it's saying if people ate 50 grams more of nuts per day, X number of deaths would be prevented. You kind of think, well, does life really work quite like that? It probably doesn't. But when you're starting to look at figures from millions of people around the world, and this is what epidemiologists do, they look at big population studies. And yes, it probably doesn't tell us the whole truth about human diets or human lives, but it tells us something. And it tells us that food, which is this wonderful thing, as every listener to this show knows, it's the great joy in life, it's the thing that's meant to nourish us, has somehow taken a wrong turn.
Well, diets, as you say in your book, diets have changed quite radically, both here and, well, across the world, really. Can you say something about how they're changing?
They're changing in manifold different ways at once. So the book isn't just saying, it's all terrible, we're eating junk food, we're going to die. Far from it. I think we're living in the best of times and the worst of times for food. I mean, the existence of a show like this, where you have people talking about wonderful startup restaurants, people cooking with interesting flavours, new herbs, people are experimenting. If I think back to my parents' generation and how some people would still be scared of garlic, thinking it was a bit too French or something. And I mean, I interviewed a lovely man from Northern Ireland for the book, who's one of the leading experts on food fraud in the UK. And he was describing his childhood, and it was half idyllic. He lived on a small farm in Northern Ireland, and everything was fresh. They grew their own raspberries, they had their own pigs. But he said he never tasted a cumin seed once. And that detail kind of stayed with me. I mean, the thought that you would have not tasted a cumin seed in modern Britain, or indeed in the modern world, is unimaginable. So I think it's wonderful that we live in a world where people have tasted a cumin seed. The downside is the change that's happening much, much more rapidly, even than the rise in healthy food and the rise in cooking, and is this vast rise in consumption of ultra-processed foods, high in sugar, yes, as we've all been told, but also hugely high in refined vegetable oils, which I hadn't realised before I researched the book, is the single ingredient in the world that's gone up the most, whether you're looking at China or whether you're looking at Europe. There have been these tumultuous changes that we've lived through in the course of not much more than a generation. And if you look at the whole of human history, diets have always changed. You know, we used to be hunter-gatherers, then we stopped being hunter-gatherers, but we became farmers. Then we became a different kind of farmer after the Industrial Revolution. Early changes took thousands of years. The later changes took hundreds of years. This change, in places like Brazil and Mexico, some of the changes have just been happening in the space of a decade or couple of decades. For example, the rise in what's called in the literature sugar-sweetened beverages and what we would call fizzy drinks. If you look at how much they've gone up in places like Brazil, and there are villages in Mexico where people don't have clean drinking water and therefore they're drinking Coca-Cola at every meal, and you're seeing children who are having all of their teeth extracted by the age of two, this is a complete change from what food used to mean. It used to be that the thing we were scared of was not having enough food.
But what's bringing it about then, this dramatic change?
What's bringing it about is a whole host of different social and economic factors. Everything's bound up together when it comes to the way that we eat. That's why I've called it The Way We Eat Now, because I wanted that to kind of allude to the fact that it's actually about how we live. So some of the changes are, you can see in any country of the world, when they go through economic development, when people move out of jobs on the land into the cities, they acquire TVs, they get electric gadgets in their kitchens, more women go out to work. Mostly brilliant, wonderful changes, in my opinion. But part of what then changes along with that is the food supply. People stop picking raw ingredients as much, they stop cooking as much from scratch. And the food industry in every country of the world has capitalized, and you get this influx of what is called ultra-processed food. And in countries such as the US and UK, more than 50% of what we're consuming now is ultra-processed. Some people say, but surely all food we eat is processed. Ultra-processed food is something else. You're taking the processed ingredients and you're subjecting them to further processes. So many of the foods that people are consuming are basically the same combinations of refined wheat, refined sugar, and refined vegetable oils, but kind of dolled up with different colourings and flavourings and additives. So we have this amazing illusion of variety, but underneath it, there's not a whole lot of ingredients.
In your book, you talk about the fact that there's a surplus now of things like grains, and that's been partly responsible as well.
Yes, there is a surplus, and this comes back to it being a complicated story that's half happy and half sad. So sometimes people say, we can't reform the food supply, that would be kind of nanny statism. And I think what people forget is actually the supply of plenty that we have now is the result of nanny statism. Governments around the world, with very good reason, after the Second World War, thought the one thing we must prevent happening is our citizens going hungry again. So governments quite reasonably thought, we've got to divert agriculture into quantity. This surplus of grain was something that was planned for. And in many ways, it was wonderful. I mean, you can say that there are millions of people alive today who would not be alive were it not for the fact that farmers figured out ways to get higher yields. But you do then have a problem when you have a situation. If you look at the United States, for example, the daily supply of calories per person into the food supply is something like 4,000. If you consider that the average person, not that there is such a person, maybe needs around half that, that's difficult. Do we waste those 2,000 calories, or do we eat them and then become overweight and develop type 2 diabetes?
You talk about the fact that often, I think, it's the multinationals who see that they can make much more profit by adding value to those grains.
Food companies, quite understandably, want to make profits. Indeed, that's their duty to their shareholders. But they're going to get much higher profits if they take the grains, refine them in some way, turn them into flakes, add sugar, say fortified with vitamins, and put it in a beautiful breakfast cereal packet, than they are if they simply put it in a bag and sell it as brown rice or wheat. And that's a problem, which I believe, just as governments tried to deal with the problems in our diet after the Second World War, that's a new problem that governments haven't quite grappled with yet, because it's happened so fast. But it's a problem for us consumers, because it may be very good value for the food companies to sell us these ultra-processed products, but it doesn't mean it's good value for us to buy them and eat them. But it's often really hard to choose anything else, particularly if, I mean, almost everyone I know, we're eating in a hurry, we're busy, we're grabbing something after work. But something needs to change in the food environment to make it easier for us to eat good food in a hurry.
But isn't there a reaction against that? And in fact, people attempting to eat good food, possibly in a hurry, by the multiplicity of diets that there are now. I mean, people avoiding eating certain things, for example.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. I think there are these bizarre diets now, and I write about clean eating in the book, which is such a strange concept. But to me, it's also a very understandable reaction to a food supply that's hurtling out of control. And people feel that in the absence of shared rules of the kind that people used to have in the past in Britain, where sort of most people were sitting down to meat and two veg or a Sunday roast dinner, as the case may be, now there are no rules, and that's terrifying. So people make up their own rules. But some of these rules are extreme, they're not founded on any evidence, and they can be really damaging because they can spread like wildfire on social media.
Overall, your book paints a picture of the world's eating habits being something to be concerned about, and you suggest some possible solutions.
I do. I mean, I have no idea what the solution is, because there is no the solution, because food is too big. But I have a final chapter, which is called Crossing the Bridge, and I talk about how I feel like the happy ending we've been telling ourselves with food is now the wrong one. So at the end of a fairy story, it often says, and they never went hungry again. And that's such a comforting thought. And I feel we're still living by that. We're still living by the joy of large portions and overflowing platters. And I feel actually we need to start telling ourselves a new story. And the one I came up with was from the story The Billy Goat's Gruff, where they cross the bridge and get to the meadow and eat the sweet green grass, which to me is we need better quality food, not just quantity. But what the sweet green grass is would be completely different depending on where in the world you are, who you are, what your issues are with eating. But I did find these glimmers of hope. One of them is the city of Amsterdam, which is one of the few, very, very few places in the world to have brought down child obesity. And they did it with a whole raft of measures and everyone working together. So they'd have schools saying the only drink is water and we don't want you celebrating birthdays with sugary treats anymore. So I know this sounds a bit odd, but children will bring in things like vegetable skewers and olives to celebrate their birthdays. But I'm sure that over time that would just get to seem normal. And it would be kind of amazing if you could start to associate vegetables and joy. It's not just change that's happened at this vast economic social scale. It's personal. Our appetites have changed. Our appetites have been warped by the food industry to the point where we think we can only quench our thirst with something sweet. But then the wonderful thing about human beings and taste is we can change. But I do think this palate change idea could benefit everyone, because whatever size you are, people benefit from eating a wide range of foods and enjoying a wide range of foods. And food is and always should be a pleasure. It shouldn't be a source of guilt. And I think part of what's gone wrong is so many of the unhealthiest foods we're being sold are being cynically marketed as health foods. If you look at all these protein bars and snack bars, and it's the same kind of those things that are biscuits, but they're kind of marketed as biscuits to eat at breakfast time. So they're supposedly meant to be healthy biscuits, but they're not. They're still the same sugar and refined wheat. And that's what breaks my heart, that somebody could be thinking, oh, this is really a good choice I'm making for myself by buying this. And yeah, you're just buying marketing.
Some countries, you say in your book, have really taken on the food giants, places like Chile, for example.
Yeah, Chile is amazing in that it's got what are probably the most radical food laws in the world at the moment, and it's becoming a kind of beacon. The hope is that other countries might follow suit. So things like, if you look at children's breakfast cereals, they've removed all of the cartoon characters because they say that's an incitement for children to eat sugar, which actually is. When you think about it, you think, that's so obvious. Of course you shouldn't be allowed to have a cartoon character on a box of something that's kind of as much sugar by weight as it is wheat. Yet somehow here we've just got inured to it and we think it's normal and we think, oh, we mustn't be nanny state and we mustn't interfere. But they've also done these really radical food labels. So most food labelling is more or less useless in terms of improving people's health, because there's way too much information. People who are buying stuff in a hurry, in a harried state with low literacy levels, it's too much information, it's overload. So in Chile, what they've done instead is just have these really stark, clear stop signs on any food that's higher than average in sugar, salt, saturated fat. And the early signs are that it is going to start to have a change on consumer behaviour and just make it easier for people to think, well, I could still have that if I want to, but this is the kind of food it is.
So there hasn't been a sort of this is nanny statism reaction in Chile?
I'm sure they've had the same conversations that people would have here. I mean, if here in London, Sadiq Khan has just placed that ban on junk food ads on the London Underground, which is a similar kind of move to what they're doing in Chile. And it's been very much welcomed by most of the campaign groups who've been working to try and improve children's health for decades. But there have also been these howls of complaint of people saying, oh, but he's drawn the line wrong. And there was an advert that was removed because it contained, I think it had things like eggs and butter. And you think, no, those aren't really junk foods. So they've got something slightly wrong there. I'm sure that the laws in Chile, they were fiercely opposed. It took years of lobbying to pass it, but they did eventually pass it. They clearly got the right political alignment at the right time.
Right, so are you optimistic or not?
I'm always optimistic because I feel there's always another breakfast. There's always another lunch. I always feel there's another chance to redo it. But the thing that makes me optimistic is, well, I was a historian by background. My early books were about food history, but this is a book about change, as you've said, and it's about rapid, rapid change. I feel that if the changes we've lived through teach us anything, is that almost everything about the way a human being eats can change in a matter of decades. And therefore it can change again. It not only can change, it has to change again. When we reach the point when all of this totally preventable human suffering, such as people having their limbs amputated due to type 2 diabetes, is coming about due to the food we eat. That's so wrong. That's so palpably wrong. It has to change, but I do think it's going to have to take external government action.
But you're going to be talking about your book, The Way We Eat Now, at the Cambridge Literary Festival. You'd like to say when you're doing that?
Yes, I'm talking about my book. I'm in conversation with Erica Wagner, who's fantastic, and she's also very passionate about food. Next Friday, Friday the 5th of April, Cambridge Literary Festival, I think it's something like 5 p.m. Do come along. Tickets available on the website. It should be a really fun event. Come with your questions about food. Yeah, I look forward to it.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your questions.
And that was Bea Wilson, whose book, The Way We Eat Now, is in bookshops now. And it's a disturbing but really important book with a very, very comprehensive look at what's going on in that aspect of food. Really worth reading and worth going along to the Cambridge Literary Festival to hear Bea speak as well.
And that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, a few tweets today, and actually one from last night. La Latina Bustamante today is running a fundraising cake sale, and that's for the Mozambique people who've been affected so badly by the recent cyclone. A couple of tweets from people on the Cambridge Market. Il Molino are giving tastings of their award-winning de-stoned organic olive oil today. And that, of course, comes direct from the farm in Italy. And Roberto's Deli, which you can find opposite Marks and Spencer's, is open today with English and continental cheeses, a range of Sicilian olives, fresh pesto, Italian cured meats, all sorts of good things. And finally, Biscotti de Deborah has tweeted to say that they are at the Burwash Larder Food Festival, but today only, they won't be there tomorrow.
Now, this coming week sees Love Cambridge Restaurant Week, with plenty of good offers and lots of restaurants participating. Alan spoke with Christian Foreman of Cambridge Bid about it.
So yeah, like you said, it's called Love Cambridge Restaurant Week, and it's starting on Monday the 1st of April and ending on Sunday the 7th of April. And the week aims to celebrate Cambridge's vibrant food scene. and hopefully it will inspire and encourage people to try new places they haven't been before and come into the city centre when they wouldn't normally do. And we've got more than 40 great restaurants involved, and all of them have provided offers to the value of £5, £10, or £15.
That's a very large number. They obviously have welcomed this idea.
Yeah, like I say, because it's the first time, I had to go and approach all these businesses and kind of explain what the week was about and what the idea was. And everyone's been really supportive and got on board. So, yeah, I think that's a really good number to start off with.
Yeah, but why has Cambridge BID doing it? What gave you the impetus?
So, well, Cambridge BID is an organisation that represents the interests of over 1,200 businesses in the city. And we deliver projects on behalf of those businesses to ensure Cambridge remains a welcoming and warm place. And we do projects like this to do that, really. And we thought supporting the restaurant sector was something that was missing part of our project. So, we thought we'd give it a go. It's a project that's done in a lot of different cities, and it's always really successful. So we thought we'd try it out.
Yeah, it's a great idea because, as you said, it enables people to try out a place they haven't been to before without much capital outlay.
Yeah, so that's the idea.
Yeah. Could you give us a few examples of people who are involved? I know you can't go through all 40 of them, but
give us a taste. We've got a mix of big national restaurants involved as well as local and independent restaurants, and they're all offering things from quick bites to eat to three-course meals. So let me have a look at this list here. Some of the independent ones, we've got Tobango on Green Street. They're offering a set menu for £15. We've got Fitzbillies. They're offering £15 lunch or a £15 afternoon tea, which I'm excited about. We've got a few of the Market Square stalls involved as well who are providing some £5 lunch offers as well. So if you're on your dinner hour next week, you can go.
I saw McDaddy's on the list, actually.
Yeah,
that's quite a big favourite.
Bridges, they're doing a £10 set menu. I went in there yesterday and tried it out, and it was very, very nice. I'd recommend that. But yeah, so there's over 40, so I won't go through them all. But if you go on our website, which is cambridgebid.co.uk/restaurantweek, there's a whole list of all the restaurants there. And all you need to do is find the restaurant you're interested in. It displays the offer, and then you can download a voucher. And as long as you present that to the restaurant you're going to, that's how you redeem it anyway.
And there's a competition involved as well.
Yeah, so we're running a competition. Another thing that Cambridge BID delivers is a citywide gift card. You might have seen it, the Love Cambridge gift card, and that can be redeemed at over 200 locations across the city. And we're giving away one of these cards loaded with £100 next week. And all you need to do to be within a chance of winning is go to one of these restaurants, dine out, have one of the offers, and then share your experiences on social media using the hashtag Love Cambridge Restaurant Week. And then at the end of the week, we'll just pick a hashtag at random, and then we'll send you a gift card.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah,
I do think that's very good. Love Cambridge Restaurant Week, and that was Christian Foreman. If Christian sounded familiar to you, then you may have heard him on Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio, which will be on next Saturday at 1 o'clock.
Yes.
Now, yesterday, we were delighted to receive a quite large package from Grantham. Now, we do know a few things about Grantham. We know about it being the home of Sir Isaac Newton. We know that Margaret Thatcher was born there. But we didn't know it's also the home of the world's first tractor, the world's first oil-powered combustion engine, the Claw Track, which is now renamed as the Caterpillar Track, and the first police women with powers of arrest. But also, and this is for interest of flavour, England's oldest biscuit, the Grantham gingerbread, which was first baked in the town in 1740 and is still baked today by Hawkins Gingerbread. And, we've got quite a lot here
there
on
is a stack,
our table. So I think we're going to try some.
Yes. I have here a lovely gingerbread man. It is a Christmas gingerbread, so in one sense we're tasting this slightly in advance of Christmas because it's not even the summer yet, but I'm going to take its head off.
Oh, well. I think there's a lot of psychology in which bits you eat first. When you eat jelly babies, did you bite their heads off first?
Or toes. Always toes.
So you've become more brutal as you've...
I think so.
Well, I still bite the toes off. And you commented that you could actually see the ginger in it, didn't you?
I could. And this says, ginger and cloves warms the taste buds, magical memories of Christmas past. Well, it's the summer, so I think we ought to go on to the other version. We're not quite the summer yet.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Sue. I'm sitting across from you in the studio, and when you took that bite, the waft of ginger just came wafting over.
Wow.
Very, very strong. Mm.
That's extraordinary. What are you eating that?
I'm going to try the same. So this is the Christmas gingerbread man, yes?
Right. We got the box of gingerbread biscuits here. Having just heard B. Wilson, my eyes went very quickly to the ingredients to see what was in there. And actually, it's quite pleasing because what's in them is simply flour, sugar, butter, egg, bicarbonate of soda, baking powder and ground ginger. There's nothing peculiar. it's all quite straightforward. Yeah. You don't feel there's any jiggery-pokery going on, or that you might die young. Mm.
Beautifully strong as well. It doesn't suffer from, you know, too much mildness, too much... what's the word? Let me just shut that window.
Well, I'm eating one of these little gingery biscuits now, and they're very, very crisp. Mm. Really crisp.
Yeah,
whereas the gingerbread
nice.
Man's nice and bendy.
Yes.
Go for a walk along the
they're
table.
Quite chewy, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, quite chewy, but these are really crisp due to the bicarb, of course, in them.
Ah, right.
But these are very nice.
They are. And they're quite delicately flavoured.
Quite delicate for me. Could have a bit more of a punch of ginger.
Right.
Not enough ginger in this for me. I'm a ginger lover, I'm sorry to say.
I prefer them, though, to ginger snaps, which I find too gingery. And also, I always feel they're going to break my teeth. Mm.
These are gorgeous. What are these called for the listener?
They're called Grantham gingerbread. They're just gingerbread biscuits.
Just Grantham gingerbread biscuits. And they come in the same packaging as, say, Jaffa cakes.
They look a bit like Jaffa cakes, yeah. Mm. And they've got really, this is sort of fun facts on the side and jokey little bits to them. Really rather fun, really clever. And I'm intrigued because I looked a bit at the backstory of these. And they were first baked in 1740 and then disappeared out of time, really. Mm. And then it's been rediscovered by the guy who now runs the Grantham Gingerbread Company, which in fact is also Hawkins.
Yeah.
But they've been relabeled Grantham Gingerbread. Interestingly, there are other gingerbread companies around of a similar nature. But this is really good, the fact that they've gone back to the history of when they first had it, 1740. Yeah. And I'm now breaking off an arm of the chocolate gingerbread. Sorry, gingerbread man. Yum. Ooh, really nice chocolatey orange hit.
And quite soft as well.
Mm.
They're chewy.
They're chewy. They're nice. Really nice.
Yeah, they are. They're good. Mm.
Yeah, and there's also an original gingerbread man and an Italian lemon gingerbread, a gingerbread with a subtle spice blend and strewn with chunks of chewy ginger and peel, after which the warming lemon scent of Italy's famous sunshine comes streaming through. And Hawkins are launching on Crowdcube on April the 8th to enable their plans to take their brand stratospheric. So you can help with that. Hawkins is Hawkens. And also, if you are a seller, you can stock their gingerbread. Details are on their website. The name again is Hawkins. So that's very nice.
Mm.
There's green onions signalling the start of our new section, and we begin as usual with jobs.
God, I'm still eating. the old Crown in Girton is reopening soon as a gastro pub, and it has lots of jobs available in the kitchen, including head chef, sous chef, commis chef. Hoping to have a softer opening towards the end of April. For details of the jobs, phone 0776 951 082.
The Oak Bistro in Lensfield Road wants full or part-time front of house people. Send your CV to inquiries at theoakbistro.com or phone Cambridge 323 361.
And finally for today, Stir Cafe in Chesterton Road are looking for front of house people. You can phone Cambridge 778 530 for details.
And please say you heard about the jobs on Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio. If you'd like to advertise a job in this section, feel free to contact sales at cambridge105.co.uk.
This weekend is the Love Food Festival at Burwash Manor, Barton. There are more than 30 food suppliers with lots of street food too. Entry and parking are both free of charge. It closes at 4 p.m. on Sunday. I often go along there. It's really good fun. It's lovely. It's a brilliant day out.
You know, it was the Cambridge Camera Awards this week, and among the winners were the Chestnut Tree in West Ratting for Pub of the Year, and Young Members Pub of the Year, so happy for this, Calverley's in Hooper Street, Cambridge, congratulations to them.
Cider Pub of the Year, the Plough in Shepreth, and the Locale Pub of the Year, Rural, is the Green Man in Triplow, and in the city, Haymakers in Chesterton Road.
And beer-wise, finally, the Dark Ale Pub of the Year is the Live and Let Live in Prospect Place.
Mmm, I like dark ale.
Mmm.
Right, well, that's it for today. We're here on alternate Sundays at 1 p.m, repeated on Sunday at 2 p.m, and then podcast early in the next week. But coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio, next is Women Making Waves with Mayor of Cambridge Gerry Bird. At 3 o'clock, bookmark. 4 o'clock, what you might have missed. 5, the football results programme. 6 o'clock, Chris Brown's Soul and Dance Show. 8 until 9, Centuries of Sound, a journey through the history of recorded sound with James and Sean. 9 until 11, Paul Cristoforo's very good programme, Rock of Ages. And at 11 until 2, oh, it's because the hour changes, I suppose, Club Beats. But that's all from us today. We'll be back on the 13th of April. And if anyone wants to send us some food, we'd be delighted.
And we'll be banging about the bangers then.
Oh, we forgot about the bangers. We haven't had time to bang.
We have not had time to eat the bangers.
So until then,
goodbye.